This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Hey, it's Jim Costa with Cash the Ticket. Mike Valeni and I are all over the tournament again this March. Breakdowns of every region and every game, who are the Cinderellas, and which team's cutting down the nets. Subscribe and listen to Cash the Ticket on the Odyssey app, wherever you get your podcasts.
Cloudy outside right now, 61 degrees, going up to 79 today. Cloudy tomorrow, highs of 78, 40% chance for showers tomorrow. Then Saturday, man, a lot of stuff scheduled. Some of it's been postponed, 85% chance for showers, highs of 76, and then some rain lingering into Sunday or not. Maybe it'll clear up by then. It's all about the timing and all that stuff, but we're going to be into the 80s next week, so springtime and summertime, everything else knocking on the door. Kathleen Roeming joins us now, Director of Social Security and Disability Policy at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Talk about Social Security in the news, DOGE in the news, a lot of stuff in the news. How you doing, Kathleen?
Good. How are you?
I'm all right. Let's start with this. Somebody texted in, Tommy, doesn't Donald Trump want to get rid of all income taxes on Social Security? I don't know. Kathleen, does he?
That's something that he's mentioned, that's for sure. Yeah, it remains to be seen whether it's going to show up in a bill this year in Congress.
All right, let's talk about what is going on with Social Security and DOGE and people going in to register or not register. It seems like it's one step forward, two steps back with the policies and so forth. Tell me what's changed, at least as far as we know.
That's right. It has been a chaotic rollout. And I guess the first thing I want to say to your listeners is that if you are receiving Social Security or SSI benefits now, please, if somebody calls you or texts you and says that you need to provide your personal information over the phone, don't do that. Scammers are taking advantage of the chaos and they're taking advantage of our seniors and people with disabilities, and I would hate for anyone to fall victim to that.
Kathleen, I think so important.
Yeah, sure.
I would ask you to say that again, because I didn't realize it until you said it, because I know there are scams that run all the time, constantly, right? But I would think with something like this going on, the scammers are thinking, holy moly, jackpot.
Exactly. There is so much confusion right now, and people are so scared. They think their benefits might be cut off. And that's just not the case. So if anybody calls you asking for your Social Security number and your personal information and tells you that your benefits are going to get cut off if you don't provide it, don't believe them. Do not give that information over the phone or via text.
So we'll start with this and maybe work back. What has changed as far as people that are either on Social Security, getting ready to apply for it, et cetera?
That's right. So for people who are applying for Social Security or people who are changing their direct deposit information, as of about 2 weeks from now, they're not going to be able to do that over the phone. Okay. Instead, they will either have to do it online at My Social Security if they're able to do that, if they can log in, and if there is an online application available for the benefit that they're applying for, or they're going to have to go in person to a Social Security Administration office to do that.
What is the, I helped a neighbor do this a while back, and I forgot exactly what it was, some kind of Social Security, something or the other, where he got an ID or an identity or something like that. What's the name of it?
Exactly. So on the website, it's called My Social Security.
That's
and to log into that, exactly, you have to use these tools, these what they call online authentication tools, and they can be pretty tricky for a lot of people. I was actually not able to log in using those tools myself.
Oh, really? Now, do you have to apply for Social Security to have one of those, or just if you pay into Social Security,
anyone,
you can?
That's right. Anyone can log in, and in fact, you should go log in and check your Social Security statement to make sure everything is right, and that's what I was trying to do when I tried to log in last month. And so that's something, you know, everyone should be able to access their benefit statements. And for many people, for retirees and people applying for disability insurance, they can also apply online using My Social Security.
So as it stands now, after 2 weeks from now, you're going to have to, or starting in 2 weeks, you're going to have to go into the office if you want to change wherever it is you want your Social Security check sent or deposited. And what else?
That's right. If you can't do it online, that's correct. You will have to go in to change your bank information for your direct deposit. And if you, same thing applies if you can't apply for retirement or disability insurance online. And also, everyone who experiences a death in the family and who is applying for Social Security survivor's benefits, so those go to widows and to kids whose parents die, all of those people are going to have to go in person to apply for benefits. The same thing goes for, go ahead.
No, I'm here every day, Kathleen. I want to hear you.
Oh, sure. The same thing goes for people who are applying for supplemental security income or SSI. That's for low income, older and disabled folks. They all will have to go in person under this new policy.
Okay. Now there is a Social Security office in our office building. And I see a lot of people, stream of people coming in, coming out every day. And I know that there's also a Social Security office on my way home that I see, and there are a lot of people sometimes waiting outside of the door to get in. And that's in normal situations. And I say normal, I don't know, the way it has been. But let's talk about when we come back, what happened or has anything happened with Elon Musk and Doge and Social Security as far as staffing goes, because it seems as though we have two roads converging here, like maybe trains on a track that's going to intersect, maybe not good, where you got people being laid off at a Social Security office, so you got less employees, but then you have more people being forced to go into the Social Security office. That seems like it could be problematic, but we'll pick it up there when we come back. Also, talk about fraud when it comes to Social Security, what's real, what's not real, and what about information that Elon Musk and his team have access to? Is that a concern or not? We're talking to Kathleen Romig, Director of Social Security and Disability Policy at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. I know one thing, Kathleen, we've had discussions about this numerous times before in the decades I've been doing this job, and a lot of people always text in and say they want the government to keep their hands off of their Social Security, which I always find interesting because it is a government program. 620, more when we come back. Traffic now, WWL. It is 625, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Kathleen Romig, Director of Social Security Disability Policy at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, about Social Security and the changes that could be coming in DOGE and laying people off. I mentioned beforehand, Kathleen, that you could have divergent or intersecting roads here where you got DOGE laying off people at the Social Security office and more people being forced to go into the offices. Is that a problem? Have people been laid off? Tell me about it.
That's exactly right. And what you were saying before is spot on. It's already hard to get help at the Social Security Administration. When you call their 800 number, on average, it takes 2 hours to get a call back. When you ask for an appointment, on average, it takes over a month to schedule one. And so we already have problems there, and it's just going to go from bad to worse. The Trump administration is planning to cut 7,000 staff from the Social Security Administration, and already 3,000 are planning to leave by the end of, by the middle of next month, actually, just as these changes are hitting. And at the same time, about 7 million more people are expected to seek in-person service at the Social Security Administration. So they're going to be calling that phone line and lining up at those offices between this change and another policy change that SSA made.
Somebody texted in here. We'd like to bring the audience in. We have a text line, the Okunard Jeweler Talking text line, 504-260-1870. It's a two-part message. The first part says, if people think their benefits are going to be cut off, they're just stupid. The second part says, get out of my yard. I made that up about the second part, but they did text in and say, if people think their benefits are going to be cut off, they're just stupid. Are people at risk of having their benefits cut off if they don't go in and do whatever they're supposed to do?
They are not at risk, and I just really want to reassure people that your benefits will not be cut off if you don't provide any information right now. And I don't think they're stupid. I think that people, scammers, unfortunately, take advantage of our seniors. They take advantage of people with disabilities, and it's not right, and they shouldn't do that.
should they get out of the yard or not? Just kidding. Let's talk about the rampant fraud and abuse that has been alleged. Does anybody really know what kind of fraud or abuse is going on with Social Security?
The fact is, Social Security has a very high level of payment accuracy, 99.7%. And so when you hear things like Trump and Musk talking about vampires and 10 million people, tens of millions of dead people getting benefits, those are just lies. It's not true. Even the handpicked commissioner of Social Security has refuted those lies that Trump and Musk are telling.
So one thing I don't understand is the end game here, because you could say pragmatically it's about, you know, making things more efficient, this, that, the other thing. But politically, any politician will tell you that you want to start losing votes, start messing with people's Social Security, and start making it more difficult for them to either contact the office or claim benefits. Am I missing something here, Kathleen? Or
no, I've been doing this for 20 years, and I am just as confused as you are. Social Security is known as the third rail of American politics. If you touch it, you get burned. And literally any politician will tell you access to Social Security is the number one thing that they hear from their constituents about when they need help.
So how do you see this playing out?
You know, I don't know. I know that, you know, when people are telling lies of this kind that are so big, like the ones that Trump and Musk are telling, it does make you wonder, is this a pretext for doing something rash that's really going to fundamentally change the program? I really don't know.
Thank you, Kathleen. Any final thoughts for us?
No, thank you so much for having me on. Have a good morning.
Thank you. Appreciate the insight. You too. Kathleen Romig, Director of Social Security and Disability Policy at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Those of you that are sending in text about personal issues, I wish I could help you, but Kathleen can't speak to that. So somebody texts in, does she really think Elon would stick his neck out this far to be questioned and find out all lies that he's propagating? Elon Musk has nothing to lose politically on all of this. He's still going to be a billionaire, and he'll still have his space thing and his car thing and everything else. I just wonder about the Republicans and President Trump and politically if they thought about this, because as she said, it is the third rail of politics, and if you start making it harder for people to get benefits under the guise of cutting waste or fraud or abuse, and they are on hold for hours and hours and hours and hours, or go into an office and wait for hours and hours and hours after they finally get there, I don't know. 6:30, we'll take a break. Talk to Mike Strain. We'll come back right now. Time for WWL First News. 6:44, 16 till 7. Rain coming in on Saturday, which is not good, and got a lot of stuff scheduled. We'll have to see what some events have been postponed or canceled already. We'll see what happens with others. Some of them are saying, you know what, as long as there's no lightning or tornadoes or anything else, we're going to go. Mike Strain joins us now, Commissioner of Louisiana Department of Agriculture and Forestry. How you doing, Mike Strain?
Man, I am great. Look, it's festival season. And you know, it's important for the commissioner to be at the festivals. And so
absolutely,
it's a lot of fun. Oh, we're gearing up for the Strawberry Festival, and that is going to be starting on Friday, and that's on the 11th. The big day in the parade is Saturday, the 12th. Parade starts at about 9:30 is lineups. Parade's at 10. Then Sunday on the 13th, food, fun, all the strawberries you could ever want to see. We'll have Jazzy out there. I want you to think about 100,000 people on the streets in Ponchatoula, Louisiana. Beautiful day. It's just so much fun. It's a big family event. And then we have festivals going on just everywhere. So it's a whole lot of fun. And look, strawberries now, you know, you can get them for about $4.99 for one of those clamshells, which is 16 ounces or about $30 a flat. And they're really, really, really good. And of course, you need to pair that up with some of these crawfish. Look, I saw them this morning, $3.25 a pound raw. And look, that's getting right now, $3.25 a pound there at Rouse's on Barone Street. It's time for a good time, right?
Man, it's amazing to see people line up at Rouse's on Friday to get them crawfish. I'm going to tell you what, they got them set up in a lobby. Not the lobby. What do you call it? Where you walk in the store with the ice chest, and they got people lined up waiting to get them and eat them up.
That's right. And look, I have it's my local IGA there in Covington. They're at Equistapaces IGA. They're out there. They got ice chests, and people, you're right, line up, and they're scooping them right there. They're hot. They're fresh. Mm-hmm. They're really good. They're select. And I can tell you, my friends in the crawfish industry, they're very, very, they're very pleased right now. it's going really well. I really don't think we're going to have any terrible cold weather because we're getting, you know, our crops in the ground. We're getting our corn in the ground, getting our rice, you know, in the ground. Won't be long. We're putting the soybeans in the ground and the cotton. And so the weather's favorable, the sugar, you know, that's coming poking back up through the ground after the freezes. So we're looking forward to a very good spring. We've been very fortunate that we've gotten some rain. They were starting to have wildfire problems in the Carolinas and through Oklahoma and out in the west. And I think we've gotten enough rain, but I can tell you the ground dries up real fast. And you're telling everybody, again, use common sense to exercise caution when you light that match.
Mike, when it comes to egg prices and so forth and bird flu, where do we stand? We talk about this every week because it's a constantly changing situation. Where do we stand, do you know?
Right. Well, we're still finding cases of bird flu. Just a couple of weeks ago, we had one of the bird houses in Mississippi, actually, and a poultry farm there. And it was a different variety of the flu. But what's happening, and now we're doing more and more on biosecurity. Also, what's happened, and I really think the federal government is putting pressure on all of these large egg companies that, look, you've got to get these prices down. If you're looking at supply and demand, we're down about 10% in numbers for our hens that lay those eggs. There's been some backing off on the purchase of eggs because of cost. Call that demand destruction. Mm-hmm. And we're actually have seen in the last week an increase between 4% and 8% in the overall stocks. All that being said, I think we're going to be okay, going into Easter, as long as people don't go in and just try to, clean out the shelves. So we're working very hard. And additionally, the Trump administration is allowing Turkey, the country of Turkey, to ship eggs here temporarily to try to get some more volume, overall in eggs. We've got to get a handle on this virus, and at the end of the day, I believe we're going to have to vaccinate because we don't have time to breed lions and chickens resistant to the disease. That would take too long. That would take years. But we cannot allow us to lose another 10% of our flocks. And so increased biosecurity, that's the main thing we can do right now. But also, we got to get a handle and vaccine, and we're going to have to start vaccinating and stop this disease in its tracks.
Along those lines, how do we know that the turkey, just like we talk about imported seafood, which we will in a little bit, how do we know the eggs from Turkey are, and again, to be clear, the country Turkey, not turkey eggs, how do we know the eggs from Turkey are, what do you call them?
Are safe. They are safe. They don't have antibiotics and everything, and that's going to have to be checked on both ends, both from third-party inspectors there, and that would be under the Food Safety Modernization Act, FSMA inspectors, and then also rechecked when they get here. Turkey produces a lot of eggs, and they ship them across the world. And so, it's not like the imported seafood is done in a very different fashion. The seafood, when you talk about crawfish, like from China, they start off from very, very, very small farms. And the way it's done, you could get the crawfish from that one small farm in a pack here in America. When you're talking about eggs, they're from very, very large farms, highly regulated, and they don't use antibiotics in those eggs. And so we will be testing for them. Say we, the government will be testing for them. So I'm not as concerned about having any antibiotics in the eggs from Turkey. And again, this is temporary. The main thing we've got to do is really focus on increasing production of eggs here in America.
Well, let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back. Text line is filling up with questions. Somebody wants to know if they can freeze strawberries. Somebody else wants to know about why the bird flu hasn't seemed to affect the price of chicken. Somebody else said, I'm not trying to be silly, but since you mentioned turkey and eggs, what about other sources of eggs from different types of poultry? We'll talk about that. And then somebody wants to know about Hootie. So a lot of questions pouring in for Mike Strain, 651, 9 till 7, traffic now, WWL. 657, 3 till 7, Tommy Tucker, WWL, Thursday morning. That means we're talking to Mike Strain, Commissioner of Louisiana Department of Agriculture and Forestry. Mike, you said you had to be at the festivals. Not only do you have to, you took an oath to be at those festivals, did you not? Mike?
Yes, Tommy? I took an oath to be at those.
Absolutely. You're fulfilling your duties.
That's my dude, and you got to sample everything, right?
Absolutely. Can you freeze strawberries or not? Somebody wants to know.
Yes, you can. I do, actually. Now, I freeze them, and so if I'm outside working, I'll come and take a frozen strawberry, and I'll let it thaw maybe a minute just out in the open and chewing it. I mean, it is delicious. It's like the most natural popsicle you ever did have. Now, ooh, when you let them thaw all the way out, they may be a little soft, but I thaw them. But I eat them frozen, and then I will use them, you know, like in desserts, frozen desserts, frozen. And so they're delicious. They're best fresh, but the frozen strawberries right out of the freezer, and just kind of nibble on them. They're incredible. You know, when you eat that wonderful ice cream and you have those frozen strawberries, mm-hmm. when you taste that, that's what you're getting. And so it's very healthy, nutritious, and low calorie.
And nothing like macerating strawberries. You put them in some sugar, it draws the liquid out, and then you got the, ooh, man, is that good. Ooh, somebody wants to know about price of chickens as it relates to bird flu.
Well, what's happened, well, if you look at chicken right now is running between $1.46 and $1.69 a pound. And so, you know, a nice fryer is going to be between $7 and $9, you know, for a fryer. But we've increased, actually, production of broilers. And so the broiler production is up year to year. We can increase production rapidly to make up for what we've lost. We've lost about 166 million birds in this flu epidemic, of which, though, if you look at the overall, there's about 9 billion broilers on deck at any point in time. But with hens that lay eggs, we only have about 330 million, and we lost 30 million, 10% of that. Mm. And that's why there's that disparity.
Real quick, how's Hootie?
Hootie's doing great. Hootie got spayed on Tuesday, and she's still telling us, look, y'all got to suck up. So she's having a glorious morning here. She's 6 months old.
Thank you, Mike. It is currently 61 degrees, kind of muggy outside, going up to 80 today, plenty of clouds, cloudy start, 40% chance for showers later on tomorrow, then 85% on Saturday. A lot of events planned, unfortunately. We'll have to see what happens with those. And then Sunday's looking pretty good, highs 82. They got a parade in Gretna. I think the only parade on the West Bank, in Gretna at least, this year. And we'll keep you updated as to festivals and weather and everything you need to know here on WWL. Zach Lemon joins us now, our friend curator of animal collections at the Audubon Insectarium. How you doing, Zach?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm great. Let me ask you this, and I might have asked you before, but I think it's everybody has a story, and I'd like to know, how does one become curator of animal collections at the Audubon Insectarium? Because when you were a kid, when you were eight, I'm guessing you didn't, and they said, what do you want to be when you grow up, Zach? I'm guessing you didn't say curator of animal collections at the Audubon Insectarium, which is a nice, prestigious position, and congratulations on having it. I'm sure you earned your way there, but I don't think that's what you said when you were a kid, right? Or did you?
I actually did.
Really?
Tommy, I'm one of those rare... I think I'm one of those rare and lucky individuals who fell in love with something at a very young age and never fell out of love with it. And frankly, most kids like playing around with bugs. It's just mm-hmm. that a lot of people grow into something else or different, and I did not. So
no,
I might
kidding.
Be a big kid, but I'm very happy.
But you know what? I'm the same way, kind of like with radio and all. I knew kind of like from when I was 4 years old. I don't think it's time to tell my story, but let's stick with you. Let's talk about... mosquitoes and the rain and this time of year and termites. We're getting into the springtime. What does that mean as it relates to bugs?
Well, insects in general are going to grow, eat food, develop more quickly, reproduce, all of these things when it is warmer. So when you live in a subtropical climate like we do, there's a long active season, really from early March until early November. You're going to see more insects and spiders and their close kin, other arthropods, doing their thing, whether it's indoors or outdoors, than in what passes for winter down here.
Mm-hmm.
And even when we have warm spikes in the winter, a lot of these animals are sort of hardwired not to resume that rapid development until it is over a certain temperature for a certain amount of days, or the amount of daylight in a 24-hour cycle has indicated that spring is here. So I think it's fair to say, even though our New Orleans weather in March can be up and down a lot, spring is here.
I want to open the Oquinart Jeweler Talk and Text Line, the audience here at 504-260-1870. If y'all have any questions about any type of bugs, insects, et cetera, when it comes to termites, what are we looking at for the swarm this year? Zach, do we know?
Well, we have more than one species of termite in New Orleans, but the introduced one that has given us the most trouble over the last few decades, as I think most of your listeners know, is the Formosan subterranean termite, which is Southeast Asian in origin. And for a while now, they've been problematic, although my understanding is that their populations are somewhat lower now than they were, say, just 20 years ago here in town and around New Orleans. I do not know if that's 100% accurate, and if so, why, but it's certainly been anecdotally my observation, and I do poke around and look for bugs a lot. We also have a terrific city department, New Orleans Mosquito, Termite, and Rodent Control, that monitors this stuff more closely. And they also will take calls from curious folks in town. I mean, they serve the citizens of New Orleans. But I will tell you that Formosan subterranean termites have a very distinctive swarming season and time and conditions under which they swarm. Typically, our first big Formosan subterranean termite swarm, big one, is around Mother's Day, so early May. And it will continue to be swarming season for them, big, heavy swarms through July. They will fly to light, but what really triggers them is when it's between 7 and 10 at night, it's very humid and not very windy. Those are the nights when you can kind of safely predict there might be a lot of them in the air.
When it comes to these big giant, somebody texted in, these big giant mosquitoes, they call them. I don't know what they really are, mayflies, whatever. Do they eat mosquitoes? We get that every year. I get that question, and I thought I'd pass it along.
I get
Daddy long legs, maybe?
Probably more of them. Yeah. Well, so the technical name for that animal is a crane fly. And in New Orleans, our crane fly population, the adults, they really make their presence known late February through around this time in March. I think everything was a little early this year. I think the warm weather that followed that snow we got on January 21st made plants and insects all move a little more quickly, just a little more quickly than usual. But anyway, crane flies, these things that look like giant mosquitoes, do have other common nicknames. Daddy long legs is a little confusing because some people use that for a close relative of a spider. And other people use them for a true spider, cellar spiders. So I like to stick with the word crane fly and remind people that they do not eat mosquitoes, nor do they take a blood meal from people. So they don't bite us, but they don't help us with our mosquito control problem. As adults, they're pretty short-lived. Some of them drink nectar from flowers, and many of them do not feed at all as adults.
So do we want to kill them or we don't if they're in the house? What do you want to do ecologically?
Live and let live. Even from an anthropocentric standpoint, you know, crane flies are a net benefit and there's no negative I can think of, except that, you know, you may not want a crane fly bouncing around in your house at night. And they're attracted to light, too. So if you have lights on and you open a door, say, to let a pet out or go to your grill, you might get crane flies in your home, but they are not going to do anything problematic at all.
Let a pet out, go to your grill. You're living my life, Zach. I can tell you that because that just resonated. I never kill those big crane flies. Is that what you call them?
Yes.
That's name? Yeah. I never kill them because it always seemed terribly unfair. It's like, where's the challenge in this? What? It's like, you know what? Leave it alone. It's not hurting you. Go ahead.
I was going to say, you said, where's the challenge? They are extraordinarily slow, awkward flyers, extraordinarily delicate. They're not chemically defended. I wonder why more of their adult population isn't consumed by predators. And you know that they have predators, of course, like almost all arthropods have something that's going to eat them on the regular. But, crane flies don't seem very well adapted for adult survivability.
It just seemed like, I feel like a bully. It's like so terribly unfair. Why would you do that? Anyway, 721, we'll talk more about ecosystems and insects and your questions at 504-260-1870. When we come back, talking to Zach Lemon, our friend, curator of animal collections at the Audubon Insectarium. He's always been buggy about bugs. 721 traffic now, WWL. 726, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking insects and bugs with friend Zach Lemon, curator of animal collections at the Audubon Insectarium. Somebody texted in about what is the most nutritious insect, but I guess that would depend on who's eating it, right, Zach?
You had some music in the background at the beginning of that question, Tommy. What was the start of it?
Oh, you want to hear more music? Go ahead and play it, Tim. I'm just kidding. So listen, I'm teasing. Somebody wanted to know about what's the most nutritious insect, but I guess that depends on who's eating it, right? Or what is eating it?
Well, that's a very good question. When we serve insects at Audubon Insectarium, we give out free samples of edible insect dishes at Bug Appetit. We have lots of information about them, and including some laminated pages and some books. And there have been a lot of studies that have been done more recently than in the past about nutrition specifically. People who are only vaguely familiar with insects will come up to the counter and say, well, they've got a lot of protein in them, right? And it is not untrue that as a percent of their total dry body weight, insects have a lot of protein. But the protein, carbohydrate, and fat ratio differs, as everyone knows, between, say, a piece of beef and a piece of chicken and a piece of fish. And there's really no reason to expect that those differences wouldn't exist between a dragonfly, which is a predator, a caterpillar, which eats leaves, a termite that eats wood, and other insects with different diets, as well as just being built differently. So the answer about what is the most nutritious insect, I don't have a good answer to it. I can tell you that every 100 grams of cricket, which is what we serve the most of, house crickets, has about 13 grams of protein and 5 grams each of carbohydrate and fat. And from a nutritional standpoint for the average human, that is a good balance, which is to say that if you just had to eat crickets, you could do a lot worse nutritionally. So in fact, they're good for you.
Do you eat insects because you can or because it's a good idea?
That depends on who you are. If you're asking me, I like the dishes that we make. What we do, though, at the Insectarium, knowing that a lot of people might be, shall we say, a little hesitant to expand their gastronomic horizons, we have dishes that have a little bit of bug mixed in with a lot of other stuff. And that way, the next time one of our guests is offered an insect to eat that's been prepared, they might say, well, I remember that thing at the Insectarium. That was pretty good. So, yeah, maybe just a handful of this, just without any extras, you know. Mm-hmm. So I personally like the taste of some insects a lot, just the bug, and others not so much. I'm the same way with, like most people, you know. I might like broccoli and not cabbage. So I like crickets. I don't care for a lot of beetle larvae, especially the scarabs. I don't care for katydids a lot, but I love honeypot ants and waxworms and dragonflies. It's variable.
You like to eat crickets, and you cannot lie. Tell me about midge flies. Somebody wants to know when midge flies are going to swarm over the lake. Do you know anything about that?
Well, I know about midges. I don't know about their timing all that well. The interesting thing about, well, midges are a type of fly, as are mosquitoes. This is all a big insect group. The scientific name is Diptera, which is from the Greek di, meaning two, and pteron, meaning wing. Interestingly, most adult insects have 4 wings, but flies, including mosquitoes, have only 2. The common midge is one family of midges that have adults that resemble mosquitoes a lot. So people frequently see common midges and they think to themselves, oh my gosh, there's 10,000 mosquitoes here. And they're actually looking at an insect that does not bite. But common midges definitely have what we would call a more synchronous emergence of adults than mosquitoes. So where mosquito populations can be thick, they don't get thick like common midges. And depending on where around Lake Pontchartrain you live, you can have the side of your boat, the side of your dock, the side of your house covered with common midges. And if you look online at a picture of a mosquito and a common midge, you will see differences in particular with the way they hold their wings at rest and the shape of their legs and how they hold them, especially their front legs. And if you're close enough to any of these insects to see them at all, if they're resting, you'll see those differences and you'll know, oh, those are midges, nothing to worry about.
Zach, a pleasure as always. Zach Lemon, curator of animal collections at the Audubon Insectarium. And technically, they don't like to be called midges. They want to be called little bugs. We'll take a break for news now, WWL. 7:47, 13 till 8. Quickly to Darren. Meyer, member of the Louisiana Board of Regents. Talk about UNO, my alma mater, Newell Norman's alma mater, a lot of people that work at WWL's alma mater, Diane Newman, the boss lady, Clancy Dubo said it built the middle class in New Orleans. I don't disagree. Welcome in, Darren Meyer, member of Louisiana Board of Regents. How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm okay, sir. Tell me what happened with UNO yesterday, and also put it in context with the Board of Regents and your role, the Board of Regents' role in all of what happens to UNO.
Okay, so the Board of Regents manages the four systems of Louisiana, the Louisiana Technical College system. We have the Southern University system, the University of Louisiana system, and an LSU system. So all four management boards report to the Board of Regents. We received a letter from the leadership of the legislature, Senate President Cameron Henry and Speaker Philip Desvilliers. And they basically sent a joint letter in February asking us to look into the possible transfer of the UNO from the UL system to the LSU system. And that has to start with the Board of Regents. Even though the legislature has to approve it, that study and the beginning of that process starts with the Board of Regents.
So that's what I wanted to know about. The study, you recommended that the study be approved, or did you recommend that UNO be included in the LSU system?
We basically recommended that there could be a transfer, but we also had some recommendations to go along with it. So we had seven recommendations that we think should be part of the process if it's to happen. And we included that in our report. It's important to know that we were pretty much given almost a year to do this study. We understand the financial straits that the University of New Orleans is in at this point, and we didn't want to delay. We already had a lot of data, and we didn't want to delay a report to get to the legislature before the session starts in the middle of April.
So while I was under the impression, and a lot of people were, that it would take a year to determine this, basically it's already been determined, and a recommendation, correct me if I'm saying anything wrong, Darren, has been passed on to the legislature, and the recommendation is that UNO be added to the LSU system. Did I say anything wrong there?
The recommendation was that we're suggesting that we move the UNO into the LSU system with certain recommendations to take place that the Board of Regents would like to monitor. The next process will take place through the legislative session. Now, whether or not that bill is done during the session or not, we don't know. I'm assuming because of the haste of the letter from the leadership of the legislature that a bill will be filed during this legislative session by one of the representatives from the New Orleans area.
All right, let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back. We're talking to Darren Meyer with the Board of Regents about their vote to include UNO recommendation, vote that would made the recommendation to include UNO into the LSU system. What is it that the Board of Regents, the conditions that they'll be looking for as they monitor this process and the bill that will no doubt be presented during the session? And also we'll talk about the whole four different systems in general. 504-260-1870 if you have any questions or comments. 750, 10 till 8, traffic now, WWL. 7:56, 4 till 8, Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with Darren Meyer, member of Louisiana Board of Regents. They voted yesterday. Darren, correct me if I'm wrong, to fast track their recommendation to move UNO into the LSU system and so it can be addressed this legislative session, if that's the case. And it is accurate?
That's pretty accurate. I mean, like I said, we had up to a year to do a report. We decided, since the universities report to us anyway, we had a lot of data. We meet with administrative teams on a regular basis. The academic and the financial sides report to the Board of Regents on a regular basis. So we had a lot of data.
I'm just watching the clock here, Darren. I'm concerned. What are your concerns, or what is the Board of Regents going to be looking for and monitoring as the legislative process goes on to move UNO into the LSU system? What do you want to see? What are you looking for?
Obviously, we'll wait for the bill to be addressed, introduced, but we're looking for our recommendations. There were seven recommendations in our report. We want an in-depth forensic financial audit from an outside accounting firm. We want a collaborative engagement between the systems. So we want the UL system as well as the LSU system to and campus leadership to meet on a regular basis regarding this transition. We also want a transition team, a formal transition team, hopefully to include members of UNO alumni and the business community in the New Orleans area. We don't want it to be as much statewide as we want the New Orleans area's focus. And we want an outside source to assess academic programs, and as well as outside source to look at facilities. There's some significant deficits regarding to facilities on a UNO campus, deferred maintenance, and so forth. We also know that this transition would include compliance from SACS, which is the accreditation body for the universities in the South. And we want some data-informed benchmark reporting. We want some reporting quarterly regarding the status of this transition from one system to the other. So that's the seven recommendations that we're requesting in our report.
I would hope, sir, that you can come back and spend an hour with us, because this is extremely important to me, as it is, I think, to the New Orleans area, about the viability of UNO, sustainability of UNO. Maybe I don't know what I don't know, but to me, I don't care if it's under the LSU system, as long as UNO is there and does provide the opportunity that it afforded me, Diane Newman, Newell Norman, Clancy Dubow, so many other people. Clancy said it built the middle class in New Orleans, and I firmly agree with him. I think it did. I want you to come back, and we'll also talk about these four systems and why do we have four systems. It would seem to me, if you're looking at economies of scale, and I know everybody wants to be their own thing, but it would seem like it would make sense to have one university system in the state. And from there, you could maybe have economies of scale, have more consistency in the operation of the facilities. Will you come back and spend an hour with us?
Would love to.
Thank you, sir. Jordan will be in touch with you. Darren Meyer, member of the Louisiana Board of Regents. We'll take a break. We come back. We're going to talk to Dr. B, Dr. Brent Wallace, Chief Medical Officer of People's Health. More than one in five Americans provide unpaid care for a loved one. We'll talk about the important work these caregivers do and talk about some resources to help you with burnout. Tommy Tucker, stay with us, WWL. .14 on this Thursday morning, more than one in five Americans provide unpaid care for a loved one. And Dr. B, our friend, Dr. Brent Wallace, the Chief Medical Officer of People's Health, joins us now to talk about the important work these caregivers do and share resources to help with burnout. Plus, we can discuss ways that you can support any caregivers in your life. How you doing, Dr. B?
Hey, Tommy. I'm doing great. How about you?
I am great. Good to talk to you. What is a caregiver? Let's start there.
Yeah, I mean, really, a caregiver can be anyone who tends to the needs of someone else. Usually someone with a short or maybe a long-term limitation, and that can be due to something like an acute illness or an injury, or it may be a long-standing disability that they have. And it could be a close friend or a family member or really anyone else who needs that help and support. And every care situation is different, so every caregiver is going to be different too. And some people expect to have that role at some point in their life, but for others, it comes as a complete surprise. And the responsibilities they're faced with and really the resources they have access to can vary tremendously.
What are some of the more common, I guess, caregiver responsibilities?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of caregivers help with daily living tasks. So that may be things related to hygiene or personal care, maybe housework for the individual or meal preparations. Caregivers also quite often help with a lot of medical tasks, and that can be really extensive. You know, things like scheduling appointments or maybe providing transportation to doctor's visits, managing prescriptions can be quite difficult. They really are advocates for their loved one's health needs overall.
It can be kind of stressful, I would think, for these responsibilities for these caregivers.
Yeah, absolutely. And all of the research shows that caregivers have a really high level of stress. A lot of them experience anxiety and some even depressive symptoms. You know, when those feelings reach a point of mental or maybe physical exhaustion, that is what we call caregiver burnout.
What is it that causes burnout?
So there's a lot of different things that we look at when, you know, when we're looking at what contributes to burnout. It's, you know, it's really natural to want to see some positive change in the people that you're caring for. But unfortunately, that doesn't always happen. And it can be really difficult to watch a loved one struggle to actually take care of themselves. That can cause a whole lot of stress. And then also, depending on what your caregiving responsibilities are, you may feel like you don't have the time or the resources or maybe even the skills to properly care for that loved one. And you might feel like you're not doing enough. It can be really hard to let go of those unrealistic expectations. And that can really affect your caregiver's ability to continue providing that help, which is so critical. And it can really turn into more stress, and that can become a cycle.
Hey, you can only do the best that you can do, but when it comes to finances, again, you can only do the best that you can do, and I would imagine that there's been some financial stress involved with caregiving?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, caregivers, they might need to take off time, unpaid time, you know, from their jobs in order to go to a medical visit with the person they're caring for and keep up with all those responsibilities. And you know, a lot of caregivers actually help to pay for their loved one's medical cost. And we know medical costs can get extremely expensive. They may even have to help with housing costs or really just those daily living, you know, the cost of living in particular.
What are some of the signs of caregiver burnout? Maybe a caregiver might recognize, or maybe the person receiving the care might recognize?
Yeah, I mean, typically what we see is the caregiver may become sad. They might be anxious or really just feel exhausted or overwhelmed. And so some of the things you'll see are changes in your sleep pattern, maybe too much sleep or too little sleep. You can actually develop some body complaints, aches and pains in particular, because pain is very related to stress levels. And you can have trouble controlling your emotions, and when it gets really bad, you may lose interest in the activities that you used to enjoy as well. That's a really bad sign.
Some ways to maybe prevent or cope with caregiver burnout?
Yeah, the most important thing I always tell people is make sure that you give yourself a break. You've got to sometimes step away from what you're doing. It's really important for your own mental and your physical health. And it's something you should never feel guilty about. A lot of people do, but you should not feel guilty about it. You can ask a friend or a family member maybe to stay with the loved one you're caring for, just so you can catch up on sleep or maybe do an activity you enjoy, and that's okay. It doesn't need to be something productive. It's just something that helps you relax and recharge a little bit and help you keep doing what you're doing. And then you want to really remember to take care of yourself. You know, stay on top of your own health, and you know, make sure that if you are not well, you're not going to be able to care for that loved one. You want to keep up with your doctor's appointments and keep up with those healthy habits like exercising and eating well. That'll also help you with the stress level.
Sounds like when you're on a plane and they give you the instructions about putting the mask on yourself first, huh?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a good analogy.
All right, let me take a break. We'll pick it up here. We come back. We're talking to Dr. B about unpaid caregivers in this nation. More than 1 in 5 Americans provide unpaid care for a loved one, but it can cause burnout on the part of the person providing the care. We'll talk about fighting that burnout when we come back. 820 Traffic Now, WWL. 825, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Dr. B, Chief Medical Officer of People's Health. Dr. Brent Wallace talking about unpaid caregivers. I get shots in my eye every 4 or 5 weeks, and I'm the youngest guy in the office, but I do see a lot of unpaid caregivers there, and sometimes I can sense some tension, I guess, because of burnout. How can caregivers fight burnout, Doc?
Yeah, I mean, don't be afraid to reach out for support. That's a really big thing. You might need to talk to a therapist or maybe a mental health professional about all of those fears and frustrations that come along with caregiving. And we actually have a lot of support groups in our area. Some are even disease specific. It's a good opportunity to get together with other people going through what you're going through and really have the opportunity to encourage each other and maybe swap some tips. And just keep in mind that there's not there's no one size fits all approach to caregiving. It's different depending on what you're having to deal with. But the one thing that's true for everybody is just don't wait until you're completely overwhelmed to start taking care of yourself. You've got to think about how you can adjust your routine to protect yourself later.
Let's say you're not a caregiver, but you know somebody who is. How can you kind of support them?
Yeah, I mean, that's really easy. Just ask them how you can help. You know, if you don't get a clear answer, which sometimes you don't, you might even want to offer some very specific suggestions like, you know, hey, can I grab some groceries for you? Can I run an errand? You know, can I go pick up prescriptions for you? Because that can take a lot of time. And then, you know, offer to sit with that caregiver's loved one for a few hours just so they can take a break. Another big thing that takes up a lot of time for caregivers is paperwork. You can actually help them with paperwork or research respite care providers in the area and support groups. Those administrative tasks are a really important part of caregiving, but they go by the wayside if you don't have time to do them.
I'm getting a lot of texts coming in. This is resonating with a lot of people that are listening because they're in that position. I know sometimes having been through it personally, sometimes people say, you know, I got this. I don't want any help. I don't need any help. What if a caregiver will not accept help or doesn't accept help?
Yeah, I mean, that's very common. A lot of caregivers won't ask for help, and then they may say, no, you know, I've got it, because they feel guilty. Mm-hmm. And what you can still do is maybe find smaller ways to show support for them. You know, maybe drop off a coffee or a homemade meal or something just to help them out. And really a big thing is just trying to stay in touch with them. You know, make a little bit of time to give them a call, maybe send them a text or stop by and offer encouragement. You know, let them kind of unload that burden a little bit through conversation, and that may make them feel a little more comfortable in accepting some more help from you.
This is valuable information, Dr. B. Any final advice for supporting a caregiver?
Yeah, I think a big thing is, you know, almost everyone at some point in their lives is probably going to be a caregiver, you know, so think about what would help you in that situation. Sometimes one of the most helpful things you can do, like I said, is just listen to them. That can be extremely useful. And remember that caregivers deal with a whole lot of fear and frustration, that they're not doing everything they could. It's hard to manage those feelings. And so anything you can do to help them with that, you know, lend an ear, do your best to kind of support them and be really attentive and present for them. And that can really go a long way to help them out.
I think the only thing you can do is, and that's my theory of life, is if you can look yourself in a mirror, say you're doing everything you can do, that's all you can do. Right, Doc?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's hard for some people to understand or accept that. And so that's why it's really important to understand, like I said, everybody's going to go through this. Most everybody is, you know, so be very supportive of people when they're faced with this issue.
Thank you, Doctor. Good information. I appreciate your time. Hope you have a good weekend.
Thanks, Tommy. You too.
Dr. B, Dr. Brent Wallace, Chief Medical Officer of People's Health. You can find out more about People's Health by going to peopleshealth.com. You can call them at 800-978-9765. You can stop by the People's Health Medicare Center on Veterans Boulevard next to Party City, 3017 Vets. And if you want to listen to this again about being a caregiver or helping an unpaid caregiver, you can download the Odyssey app, use the Rewind feature, or go to WWL.com, click on my name. The audio will be posted in a little while. And God bless all of y'all that are doing this. I know it's hard, but you really are doing God's work. 8:30, time for WWL First News. 8:45, quarter till 9, Tommy Tucker, WWL, joined by Leslie Harris, New Orleans City Council member, our friend. How you doing, Leslie?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay. Are you
Hi.
Okay? You doing all right? Yeah.
I'm all right. I'm great.
Do you have a council meeting today or not at 10 o'clock?
We do, yes.
Okay. At 9 o'clock, you need to either listen or you need to go back and listen to the audio, because we're going to have Brian Hare on, who is the author of Puppy Kindergarten and a professor of psychology and neuroscience at Duke University. He runs the Duke Canine Cognition Center, and he's going to tell us what dogs are thinking, how do we read their body language, and do they know what we're saying to them? And I know you've had some issues with those miscreants of yours, right?
I have two test subjects. He can borrow, yes.
Yeah, I'd be glad to ship them up there for a couple of... You take them, Doc. Take them for a couple of months. God bless you. Good luck. Let's talk about the homeless center that the governor opened. I know I see some different numbers. My own math showed me that it was like $162,000 per person of the people that didn't leave, and that just astounds me. I don't know. Nobody's asking a question. Everybody's, you know, some people are asking questions. I get texts saying, well, the city wouldn't do anything, so the governor stepped in and got the homeless people off the street for the Super Bowl and for the Taylor Swift concert, but... forget the humanity part of this. For $162,000, you could have bought somebody a house. I don't understand how it costs that much. Do you? And I know your figure says $85,000 to $105,000 per person, but I looked at the number of people that 108, I think it was, and divided it by the number that the governor's office put out. It didn't make any sense to me. Thoughts?
It doesn't make any sense. And that figure, whether your figure is right or my figure is right, that's only for 2.5 months of that temporary shelter. That does not include the cost of housing people after the shelter closed or services given to the folks after the shelter closed. So the math just doesn't add up. If you actually put, you know, if you multiplied it by 12 months, let's just say the shelter was open for a year, that would be around, I think, $350,000 per person. Again, you could house somebody through what the city was doing for multiple years. The city's plan would cost about $21,000 per person per year, which would include housing, health care, additional treatment, and wraparound services. So we were on track to do to house people for a lot less than that temporary shelter cost. And I'm concerned because once it closed, people were put into the low barrier shelter. There are some people who are unaccounted for, and we're seeing people pop back up on the streets, but more importantly, in neighborhoods and in blighted properties, as we predicted this would happen once the shelter closed.
So the bottom line is, and correct me if I'm saying anything wrong here, and you're a very talented attorney, and keep me out of trouble here, Leslie, I'd like to retain you if I can, but... we spent $162,000 to get the homeless out of sight for the Taylor Swift concert and the Super Bowl. The homeless center is now, the shelter is now closed. Of the 108 people found housing at a cost of $162,000 per. And for the other people, they're in low barrier shelters or are making their way back to the street. So $162,000 later, while 108 people did find housing, you could have done it. The city was doing it for $21,000, not $162,000, if I'm correct there. And meanwhile, where'd all that money go? And we're right back to where we started. Did I say anything that's inaccurate there?
That's absolutely accurate. And it's perplexing. And, you know, the legislative auditor just released a report on the city's effort to shelter people and said that we were following best practices. You know, we needed some additional data sharing, but also that the state of Louisiana really wasn't helping the city of New Orleans fund homelessness efforts prior to the transitional center. So I would encourage the legislative auditor to dig into this transition center to see where the money went, how it was spent, who it went to.
I think, you know, a lot of times, and look, I don't know what I don't know here, but a lot of times people, you know, throw a lot of red herrings out there with homeless and get people fired up about that, or Democratic administration get people fired up about that. Meanwhile, they're not keeping track of the money, and sometimes, you know, you get people looking red or blue and they don't see green, which is, again, I hope somebody looks into this, because, and I'm not going to let it go, because I don't understand how it cost, and again, by my math, $162,000, by yours, $85,000 to $125,000 per person for 2.5 months, and we're basically going to be in a couple of weeks right back where we started. We'll pick it up. We come back with Leslie Harris, 850, 10 till 9. We'll talk about her role in reducing the NOPD's backlog of DNA tests, which is very important. Leslie Harris, Joe Geruso, I'm just going to pick a couple of names for you. Very talented people. Leslie left a partnership at a law firm for public service. Joe Geruso is leaving public service to go to a law firm because he's got kids to go through college and everything else. And I think both of them are interested in the best interests of the city. That's just my opinion. 8:51, 9 till 9, traffic now, WWL. Tommy Tucker, WWO, back with Leslie Harris. Leslie, I don't want to skip over this too quickly, but to go back to the legislative auditor, the audit that they conducted sent a letter to the Speaker of the House and the President of the Senate, Philip DeVille, Cameron Henry, respectively, dated March 21st of 2025. That audit found, if you can give me a quick executive summary.
Sure. The audit found that the city of New Orleans was following best practices in decommissioning the encampments, that we had decommissioned 51% of the planned 14 encampments. So we had cleared 8 encampments, housed people of 14, and we're on track to continue that. It also said that the state needed to help support this effort. And so I encourage anybody to go online and read the entire report. It has some interesting findings.
Let's talk about backlog of DNA and NOPD.
Yeah. I can tell you that when I first got into office, myself and my chief of staff visited the state crime lab. The state crime lab tests not only DNA kits from the city of New Orleans, but from across the state. And our DNA kits go in line with other jurisdictions. So we literally saw stacks of DNA kits just sitting there waiting to be tested. That was really heartbreaking given the low clearance rate, especially of our sexual assault cases here in New Orleans. And so I allocated $3 million to clear that backlog, and we are on track to clear it. We have tested 926 cases, and we will continue to work with the state crime lab on clearing that backlog.
What happens now with the homeless situation in New Orleans now that the governor's facility wherever it was on Gentilly is closed? What happens now, Leslie, as far as the city and resources and getting homeless people off the streets?
We will continue to do what we were doing before the governor opened the transition center, which is intensive outreach to people who are unhoused, getting them the services that they need and getting them the housing that they need.
What will you be paying attention to at the council meeting today?
Oh, everything. We have a lot of budget items on track. We also have a tree ordinance that I've authored to protect our tree canopy. So that should be an interesting discussion.
Thank you, Leslie Harris. I appreciate your time as always. And look, seriously, listen. I know you can't listen to the next hour, but go back and find the audio with this dog psychiatrist, all right?
Absolutely. Thank you.
We all are going to need some medication or something, I guarantee you, with the dogs. Thank you. Brian Hare will be here next, author of Puppy Kindergarten and a professor of psychology and neuroscience at Duke University. Text your questions in, 504-260-1870. What's your dog doing, and have you ever wondered why he or she is doing it? Body language. We'll talk about it when we come back. WWL. Thank you, Dave. This is going to be a fun hour. And if you have dogs or interact with dogs at all and you have any questions, 504-260-1870, you think you know what they're thinking? I got a new dog, Teddy, and sometimes I don't think he gets my sense of humor as I pass these witty comments along to him. Maybe it's a different point of reference. I don't know. But Brian Hare joins us now, author of Puppy Kindergarten, a professor of psychology and neuroscience at Duke. He runs the Duke Canine Cognition Center. Good morning, doctor. How are you?
Good morning, Tommy Tucker. Good morning, New Orleans. Pleasure to be with you.
It's a pleasure to talk to you. I'm working from home today, and I got my little friend Teddy here with me, and I'm going to start with this since he brought it up. What makes a dog get the zoomies? Where do those come from?
Teddy's got the zoomies, huh?
Yeah. He had them. Well, now he's laying down flat like he just got run over by a car, God forbid.
Well, Good for him. Yeah, yeah, no, Zoomies are all about, you know, something obviously super exciting that a dog is, you know, happy that they're anticipating that is about to happen with you. They're happy to see you, and, you know, it just makes them really excited because maybe we're going to have a good time playing. And the other thing is that Zoomies are another sign that, you know, your dog needs exercise all the time. And just like people, dogs need exercise, and so they're just having at it.
Doc, I was playing with this dog for 3 hours yesterday, and eventually he looked at me like he was bored, and it's like, Teddy, I don't know what to tell you, buddy. That's life. It's not always 100% exciting. There are boring moments. Do dogs need to be entertained constantly? What's going on here?
No, they don't need to be entertained constantly, but at Duke, and the topic of the puppy kindergarten, the book we wrote, it's all about how what we learned after we raised 100 service dog puppies. One of the big things we learned is, you know, I don't know if is Teddy still a puppy?
He was born in October. He's a mutt. He's not, and some people take a reference at that. Is that a pejorative term, mutt, by the way?
You know what? I like to call any dog that is of mixed breed an American dog.
All right, an American dog. But Margot Robbie called herself a mutt in Wolf of Wall Street, and I didn't find it offensive. So, you know, anyway, Teddy.
I don't think it's offensive at all. But if he was born in October, or you got him in October, is that what you said?
Born in October.
Oh, he's born in October. Okay, so yes, he's still a puppy. So a dog is really is still growing until they're two. They're not really fully grown until they're two. And so when a dog is, you know, 6-8 months of age, they are going to need a lot more activity than they'll need when they're fully grown. So one of the things we learned is a lot of the behavior problems that people encounter, it's really that dogs need a lot of exercise. And, you know, when we had any problem behaviors of the, you know, over 100 puppies we raised, if we looked at the exercise they were getting and we, you know, kind of bumped it up a little bit, then a lot of the troubles we were having would go away with those dogs. So it is true that they don't need constant entertainment, but they do need a lot of exercise. And so I'm sure Teddy is giving you a run for his money if he's that age.
Yeah, well, sometimes I got to carry him back because I'll outwalk him. You wrote the first book
you
wrote.
There you go.
Genius of Dogs, you and your wife Vanessa wrote it, Puppy Kindergarten. Tell me about the work of the Duke Canine Cognition Center. What is all that about?
Well, we've been working on lots of things to understand the problems that dogs can solve and some of the problems they can't solve, and we're using that information to try to help with training and how we can improve predictions about which dogs will be most trainable to do all the amazing jobs that dogs do today. You know, with all the technology that we have, you'd think that dogs are kind of obsolete, but they have more jobs than ever, whether it's searching for things, drugs or bombs, et cetera, or even endangered animals. And then there's dogs that help people with all sorts of disabilities, whether it's physical or just needing, you know, a dog that can help you, you know, stay calm or feel confident. One of my favorite things is we've had dogs that we've helped raise for Canine Companions, our main partner in the service dog world. And one of our most proudest accomplishments is we've had a dog that we helped raise and had a student help raise who went on to be a courtroom dog. And it's a dog that stays with kids when they're having to testify. And allows the kid to feel confident, and so they're not afraid in what would otherwise be a really scary moment in their life. So we're studying how to help identify and have dogs succeed at training for all these really important jobs, and we're learning things that are relevant to you at home, too.
Somebody texted in and said, because I want to bring the audience in here in our conversation, we'll wax and wane, can you teach an old dog new tricks?
Absolutely. Dogs can learn throughout their lives. They do have cognitive decline, which means once they reach about the age of 10, they start to experience cognitive decline and they have a harder time remembering things. They have a harder time inhibiting. But it's only once they reach the age of 10, and they can still learn new things. Just because they're, you know, having a harder time remembering or inhibiting doesn't mean they can't learn new things. Absolutely. A dog can learn throughout their whole life.
Somebody texted in and said, I feel like I'm more of a companion to my dog than the dog is a companion to me. Talk about the whole human-dog relationship, doctor, if you would.
Well, you know, dogs have a ton of individual variability. As anybody who's had multiple dogs in their life knows that every dog is its own being, its own personality. So sure, there are some dogs that it can feel like you're their companion. Maybe you even feel like you're working for them. I get it. I've been there. But the relationship that we have with dogs is very special. It goes back over 15,000 years. And our two species have, you know, evolved to live together and socially bond with each other, work together, live and, you know, play together. So it really is a pretty unique relationship.
Somebody texted in, when my dog is sniffing the wind without context to what he's sniffing, what's going on there? Do you know why dogs just sniff the wind? Something in the distance? Somebody's cooking burgers or something?
Obviously the ability of dogs to smell or use their olfactory sense is pretty remarkable. So if they're smelling, I'm sure they're trying to understand if there's another dog nearby, or maybe they're smelling food or any other chemical that they might be able to detect and understand what it is. One thing that is oversold, though, is sometimes it's thought that dogs are sort of always using their nose, but it ends up that we have lots of research to show that they really prefer to use their eyes. If they can see something, they'd rather use their visual abilities, and then they kind of go to their noses when they can't see. So, for instance, we have a game we play where they have to find something, like a toy or food, and if the lights are on, they prefer to use their eyes, and they actually fail if we hide it and they don't know where it is. They could smell it, but they don't. And as soon as we turn the lights off, they can find it with their nose. It's pretty remarkable. And we turn the lights back on, they can't find it again because they're trying to see where it is, and we turn the lights off, and then they can find it with their nose. It's pretty cool.
Sounds like you love your work, and you're a lucky man to do it, and your wife as well. The book Puppy Kindergarten, we'll talk more about that in a little bit. Somebody texted in, look, I'm going to try to keep this appropriate not gross or anything like that, but basically, and I go through this myself, where the dog has to go out at night and he's sniffing and sniffing and sniffing, and it's like, okay, I understand when I'm traveling, I know what places have the clean restrooms and which ones don't, and I'm a little picky about that, but when the dog is outside and sniffing the yard, and it seems to take forever until he or she finally decides where they want to, you know, what is going on there, do you know?
So there's a lot. When dogs go to the bathroom, it's not just about relieving themselves. Always, often they're it's like a twofer. They're going to the bathroom and relieving themselves. But if they're, especially if they're out in the neighborhood, off their own sort of normal place they hang out, they're leaving information for others. They're trying to say, "Hey, I was here," and it's a way to communicate. Because they're so, you know, they use their sense of smell so much that they can leave a message for all the other dogs. And so they're reading the newspaper. They're when they're out sniffing around trying to figure out, you know, where do they want to leave their next article about themselves? Do they want to leave it, you know, where there's some old, you know, news that's from so long ago that it's not that interesting? Or, you know, maybe they'll leave some information when they go to the bathroom where a lot of dogs have been recently. So they're probably looking for a place that's going to be, you know, likely that someone's going to read their news that they leave and make.
Well, when it's 2:00 in the morning and I want to get back to bed, I wish you'd read a little bit more quickly. We're talking to Dr. Brian Hare, author of Puppy Kindergarten. We'll talk more about the book about raising the perfect dog, a professor of psychology, neuroscience at Duke University, runs the Duke Canine Cognition Center, been studying dogs for a long, long time. He's probably forgotten more than most of us will ever know. Somebody texted in about cobbing. We'll talk about that. And my buddy Teddy has a little issue with that until I tell him to stop. And if y'all have any questions about raising dogs, types of dogs, dog behavior, etc., please text them into the Oquinar Jeweler Talk and text line 504-260-1870. And I'll pass them along to Dr. Hare when we come back. 920, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Thank you, Dave. This is going to be a fun hour. And if y'all have any, if you have dogs or interact with dogs at all and you have any questions, 504-260-1870, you think you know what they're thinking? I got a new dog, Teddy, and sometimes I don't think he gets my sense of humor as I pass these witty comments along to him. Maybe it's a different point of reference. I don't know. But Brian Hare joins us now, author of Puppy Kindergarten, a professor of psychology and neuroscience at Duke. He runs the Duke Canine Cognition Center. Good morning, Doctor. How are you?
Good morning, Tommy Tucker. Good morning, New Orleans. Pleasure to be with you.
It's a pleasure to talk to you. I'm working from home today, and I got my little friend Teddy here with me, and he just, I'm going to start with this since he brought it up. What makes a dog get the zoomies? Where do those come from?
Teddy's got the zoomies, huh?
Yeah. He had them. Well, now he's laying down flat like he just got run over by a car, God forbid.
Well, good for him. Yeah, no, zoomies are all about, something obviously super exciting that a dog is, you know, happy that they're anticipating that is about to happen with you. They're happy to see you, and, you know, it just makes them really excited because maybe we're going to have a good time playing. And the other thing is that zoomies are another sign that, you know, your dog needs exercise all the time. And just like people, dogs need exercise, and so they're just having at it.
Doc, I was playing with this dog for 3 hours yesterday, and eventually he looked at me like he was bored, and it's like, Teddy, I don't know what to tell you, buddy. That's life. It's not always 100% exciting. There are boring moments. Do dogs need to be entertained constantly? What's going on here?
No, they don't need to be entertained constantly, but at Duke, and the topic of the puppy kindergarten, the book we wrote, it's all about how what we learned after we raised 100 service dog puppies. And so one of the big things we learned is, you know, I don't know if is Teddy still a puppy?
He was born in October. He's a mutt. He's not, and some people take a reference at that. Is that a pejorative term, mutt, by the way?
You know what? I like to call any dog that is of mixed breed an American dog.
All right, an American dog. But Margot Robbie called herself a mutt in Wolf of Wall Street, and I didn't find it offensive. So, you know, anyway, Teddy.
I don't think it's offensive at all. But if he was born in October, or you got him in October, is that what you said?
Born in October.
Oh, he's born in October. Okay, so yes, he's still a puppy. So a dog is really is still growing until they're two. They're not really fully grown until they're two. And so when a dog is 6-8 months of age, they are going to need a lot more activity than they'll need when they're fully grown. So one of the things we learned is a lot of the behavior problems that people encounter, it's really that dogs need a lot of exercise. And, you know, when we had any problem behaviors of the, you know, over 100 puppies we raised, if we looked at the exercise they were getting and we, you know, kind of bumped it up a little bit, then a lot of the troubles we were having would go away with those dogs. So it is true that they don't need constant entertainment, but they do need a lot of exercise. And so I'm sure Teddy is giving you a run for his money if he's that age.
Yeah, well, sometimes I got to carry him back because I'll outwalk him. You wrote the first book
there you go.
Genius of Dogs, you and your wife Vanessa wrote it, Puppy Kindergarten. Tell me about the work of the Duke Canine Cognition Center. What is all that about?
Well, we've been working on lots of things to understand the problems that dogs can solve and some of the problems they can't solve, and we're using that information to try to help with training and how we can improve predictions about which dogs will be most trainable to do all the amazing jobs that dogs do today. With all the technology that we have, you'd think that dogs are kind of obsolete, but they have more jobs than ever, whether it's searching for things, drugs or bombs, et cetera, or even endangered animals. And then there's dogs that help people with all sorts of disabilities, whether it's physical or just needing, a dog that can help you, stay calm or feel confident. One of my favorite things is we've had dogs that we've helped raise for Canine Companions, our main partner in the service dog world. And one of our most proudest accomplishments is we've had a dog that we helped raise and had a student help raise who went on to be a courtroom dog. And it's a dog that stays with kids when they're having to testify. And allows the kid to feel confident and so they're not afraid in what would otherwise be a really scary moment in their life. So we're studying how to help identify and have dogs succeed at training for all these really important jobs. And we're learning things that are relevant to you at home, too.
Somebody texted in and said, because I want to bring the audience in here in our conversation, we'll wax and wane. Can you teach an old dog new tricks?
Absolutely. Dogs can learn throughout their lives. They do have cognitive decline, which means as they once they reach about the age of 10, they start to experience cognitive decline and they have a harder time remembering things. They have a harder time inhibiting. But it's only once they reach the age of 10, and they can still learn new things. Just because they're, you know, having a harder time remembering or inhibiting doesn't mean they can't learn new things. Absolutely, a dog can learn throughout their whole life.
Somebody texted in and said, I feel like I'm more of a companion to my dog than the dog is a companion to me. Talk about the whole human-dog relationship, Doctor, if you would.
Well, you know, dogs have a ton of individual variability. As anybody who's had multiple dogs in their life knows that every dog is its own being, its own personality. So sure, there are some dogs that it can feel like you're their companion. Maybe you even feel like you're working for them. I get it. I've been there. You know, the relationship that we have with dogs is very special. It goes back over 15,000 years. And our two species have, you know, evolved to live together and socially bond with each other, work together, live and, you know, play together. So it really is a pretty unique relationship.
Somebody texted in, when my dog is sniffing the wind without context to what he's sniffing, what's going on there? Do you know why dogs just sniff the wind? Something in the distance? Somebody's cooking burgers or something?
Yeah, I mean, obviously the ability of dogs to smell or use their olfactory sense is pretty remarkable. So if they're smelling, I'm sure they're trying to understand if there's another dog nearby, or maybe they're smelling food or any other you know, chemical that they might be able to detect and understand what it is. I mean, one thing that is oversold, though, is sometimes it's thought that dogs are sort of always using their nose, but it ends up that we have lots of research to show that they really prefer to use their eyes. If they can see something, they'd rather use their visual abilities, and then they kind of go to their noses when they can't see. So, for instance, we have a game we play where they have to find something that, like a toy or food, and if the lights are on, they prefer to use their eyes, and they actually fail if we hide it and they don't know where it is. They could smell it, but they don't. And as soon as we turn the lights off, they can find it with their nose. It's pretty remarkable. And we turn the lights back on, they can't find it again because they're trying to see where it is, and then we turn the lights off, and then they can find it with their nose. It's pretty cool.
Sounds like you love your work, and you're a lucky man to do it, and your wife as well. The book Puppy Kindergarten, we'll talk more about that in a little bit. Somebody texted in, look, I'm going to try to keep this appropriate not gross or anything like that, but basically, and I go through this myself, where the dog has to go out at night and he's sniffing and sniffing and sniffing, and it's like, okay, I understand when I'm traveling, I know what places have the clean restrooms and which ones don't, and I'm a little picky about that, but when the dog is outside and sniffing the yard, and it seems to take forever until he or she finally decides where they want to, you know, what is going on there, do you know?
So there's a lot. When dogs go to the bathroom, it's not just about relieving themselves. Always, often they're it's like a twofer. They're going to the bathroom and relieving themselves. But if they're, especially if they're out in the neighborhood, off their own sort of normal place they hang out, they're leaving information for others. They're trying to say, "Hey, I was here," and it's a way to communicate. Because they're so, you know, they use their sense of smell so much that they can leave a message for all the other dogs. And so they're reading the newspaper. They're when they're out sniffing around trying to figure out, you know, where do they want to leave their next article about themselves? Do they want to leave it, you know, where there's some old, you know, news that's from so long ago that it's not that interesting? Or, you know, maybe they'll leave some information when they go to the bathroom where a lot of dogs have been recently. So they're probably looking for a place that's going to be, you know, likely that someone's going to read their news that they leave and make.
Well, when it's 2:00 in the morning and I want to get back to bed, I wish you'd read a little bit more quickly. We're talking to Dr. Brian Hare, author of Puppy Kindergarten. We'll talk more about the book about raising the perfect dog, a professor of psychology, neuroscience at Duke University, runs the Duke Canine Cognition Center. been studying dogs for a long, long time. He's probably forgotten more than most of us will ever know. Somebody texted in about cobbing. We'll talk about that. And my buddy Teddy has a little issue with that until I tell him to stop. And if y'all have any questions about raising dogs, types of dogs, dog behavior, etc., please text them into the Oquinar Jeweler Talk and Text Line, 504-260-1870. And I'll pass them along to Dr. Hare when we come back. 920, Tommy Tucker, WWL. 9:43, 17 till 10, fascinating hour with Dr. Brian Hare, author of Puppy Kindergarten, a professor of psychology, neuroscience at Duke University. He runs the Duke Canine Cognition Center. Doctor, a text comes in and says, my dog enjoys watching inside the mind of a dog. In fact, New Year's Eve when the fireworks were making her nervous, I turned on Inside the Mind of a Dog, and she sat in my chair and watched it and ignored the fireworks, and it calmed her down. So there you go. You got a fan.
That's amazing. I'm so glad it helped.
Let's talk about, well, I'm sure you have more than one fan. Let's talk about a horrible incident last week in New Orleans. Three pit bulls got out, mauled an 81-year-old woman to death while she was putting her garbage out. That brings to mind the question of, you know, somebody texted in about certain breeds are inherently dangerous. People shouldn't be able to own them. There are countries that have taken that action. As I was conducting an interview about this the other day, I got to thinking maybe it's not so much about the breed of the dog as much as the size of the dog. What are your thoughts on all of this as far as are some breeds inherently dangerous? I know, real quick, I'll tell you, I was at Petco years ago, saw a smaller man walking a cane Corso, and he was not in control of this dog at all. And I was wondering, worried about the safety of him and everybody in the store, including myself at that moment. Thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot. I'm so sorry to hear that story. It's horrifying to hear that this happened to someone who, you know, completely unjustified and horrific to hear. So, I mean, it's just so saddening. And for me, as a scientist, I have to go to the scientific literature. I have to look at what do we know scientifically, you know. And so, when you do that, what you learn is that what we normally talk about in the media or what we share on social media is it's something about a certain breed that might be causing the problem. And the truth is that the scientific evidence just does not bear that out. It ends up that if you raise, whether it's a Rottweiler, a Pit Bull, a German Shepherd, any larger dog that, you know, or a Doberman Pinscher, whatever it is that might be really intimidating, if you raise it in a positive way, you socialize that dog so that it's met a lot of people when it's young and been in different places and met different dogs and had a lot of really good experiences, there's absolutely no difference in how breeds are responding aggressively, that you can say, oh, this breed is, you know, having a problem with aggression and this one's not. There is certainly an interaction where if you raise a dog in a way that, you know, it's not growing up with that positive experience, you're going to raise the possibility that a dog is going to then respond to others aggressively. And so my guess is that, you know, the dogs in this event were raised in such a way that, you know, they probably were not experiencing what you would hope pet dogs were experiencing if we wanted them to be good citizens. And so I don't think it's about a breed of a dog. I think it's more about how people are treating dogs and how they're raising their dogs. And breed really doesn't help us. It doesn't communicate what you'd think it does about aggression. In fact, if you go to the data and you look at which dogs bite people the most frequently, it's actually small dogs that bite people the most. It's just that they can't hurt you really badly. I would say really if we want to have less of this happening, it's all about helping people understand that, you know, raising a great dog is all about making sure, just like with a kid or any other animal, that they feel confident and have positive experiences with others in other strange places. Otherwise, you know, we're going to be stuck where we are right now.
Somebody texted in, well, two texts actually on either side of the equation. One of them wants to know the best way to bring a dog in and socialize with a new baby. Somebody else wants to know about a dog. Wait, it's the other way around. One of them has a baby and wants to know about bringing the dog in. The other one has a dog and wants to know about bringing a baby in. So I guess it's the same way from either direction.
Yeah, so I would, that's a great question. So it depends. Those are definitely two different situations. So if you're bringing a dog into a home that is their new home, it's a little bit easier and because the dog is going to be experiencing all sorts of new things and the baby happens to be there. I don't know how old the baby is, but I would certainly, if we're talking about a toddler, so a child who can get around and move, I definitely, with our own dogs, even a dog you very much trust, you would never leave a toddler alone with a dog. I would never do that because it's not fair to the dog, because the toddler may do something that scares the dog, or maybe the kid jumps on the dog, and it's a perfectly normal interaction for a toddler, and it scares the dog, and the dog nips the toddler. I can tell you, I've seen when toddlers or young children are bitten by dogs, it tends to be they get bitten in the face, and the scars can be horrific and lifelong. And so, I love dogs. I'm a huge dog lover, but I certainly, as a parent, would not, even as much as I love dogs and trust them, even my most trusted best friend, I'm not going to leave them alone without parental supervision. With the dog. In terms of introducing a baby into a house where there's already a dog that sort of, this is my house and I'm, you know, like Lady and the Tramp style, it's kind of the same thing, except for you want to be a little more patient with a dog, potentially, that they have a new, friend that they're going to have to make. But normally most dogs are not going to have a hard time with that. You just want to be sensitive and take your time with it, understand that the dog may need some time to approach and explore, and you're definitely going to want to be there and trying to make it as positive as possible.
I get a lot of text here coming in, and I'll combine them all into one big text before we let you go, and that is about choosing the right dog for the right family. Rescues as opposed to purebreds. How do you determine a responsible breeder? I'm going to throw all that to you in one handful, Doc, and you can jump in where you feel comfortable.
So if, in our new book, Puppy Kindergarten, we raised over 100 dogs, and we actually raised them in two different ways. And in one case, we raised them on Duke's campus, and we kind of hyper-socialized them. We socialized them with exposure to all sorts of things. They went more places than a normal puppy goes. They met more people than a normal puppy would. Our puppies met over 1,000 people in a few months. They met dogs more often because they were actually raised with other dogs. The other dogs we compared them to, they were raised in people's homes in the normal way that you might raise a dog. And those dogs were very well socialized, too. They met lots of dogs and other people, but at Duke, we hyper-socialized them. We really exposed them to extra stuff. And what we found is that the two dogs, when we compared them on their problem-solving abilities, their ability to remember, their ability to learn, their ability to have self-control, those things were all the same as they developed. It didn't really affect how they thought about the world or solved problems. But what it really affected, and we have very nice evidence on this, is it really affected their emotions, their emotional reactivity, and their confidence. Dogs that were hyper-socialized at Duke were extra confident. They're really able to meet new people and go new places in a way that the dogs raised at home are a little bit more, are a little less confident. So all of this is to just emphasize again that early socialization is really important. So the question, though, was like, where do I get my dog? Where do I find my dog? And our recommendation is that, raising puppies is hard. And that's why I was giving that example. It was exhausting. We had at Duke, we had over 100 people every semester raising 4 or 5 puppies as a team. And so one idea, and I'm sure in New Orleans there is a place to shelters to work with, there are programs that are known as foster programs, where you can actually foster a dog for a weekend or a week, and you can take the dog home from the shelter. You give it a really nice vacation from the shelter, and it's really just to give them a break from the shelter. And you can host them and have a good time, but what happens is you can foster multiple dogs, and in doing this, it's kind of like a tryout. You get to try out and see if this dog is the dog for you. And we've seen, and there's even the beginnings of evidence in the scientific literature, that this is really a great way to find your new best friend. You're helping out a dog at a shelter, but you're also figuring out, is this the best dog for you? I had a friend who did this, and for 2 days they had a dog. It was going fantastic, but then the dog started to show a behavior that they thought was going to be a real problem for them. And, you know, they took the dog back, which is fine because they gave it a break. And then they later found the dog that is just a dream for their life. So I'd say that's my first recommendation. The second recommendation is, if you really do want to have a puppy, which is wonderful, you know, you're going to want to think hard about how are you during the workday going to let the dog out. Puppies need to go out 3 times a day. They have 3 periods of activity. They need to go out constantly, both to the restroom and to exercise. And then the next thing is, when you get your dog, a lot of people think really hard about breed and that that somehow communicates something really important about what they might grow up to be like. And it ends up that the evidence is not there for that scientifically. There's so much individual variability within any one breed. If you get, I love Labrador Retrievers myself. I'm going to get a Labrador Retriever because I imagine it's going to be this way. I mean, breed tells you a little bit, but it doesn't tell you that much. So definitely seeing parents is good. Thinking about breed, I don't know how helpful that is. Fostering is a great idea. And if you're going to get a puppy, make sure you've got the time to really be home for it for the first 6 months and being able to let it out and get it exercised as
Doctor,
it needs to be.
Thank you for your time. Never enough. Author of Puppy Kindergarten, professor of psychology, neuroscience at Duke University, runs the Duke Canine Cognition Center. Books, Puppy Kindergarten, Survival of the Friendliest, The Genius of Dogs. You get them at all usual outlets, Doctor?
You can. That's right. Anywhere where books are sold.
And a Netflix show as well. Thank you, sir. 9:55. We'll take a break, find out what Newell Norman's got coming up when we return on WWL.